Gospel of John, chapter 11, and we'll be reading verses 38 through 44. This can be found on page 1064 of the Bibles that are in the seats in front of you. This is the seventh and final sign from the first half of John's Gospel. We've been journeying for 6 weeks now studying these various signs, and all of these seven signs, especially this one, as you'll see, they all point to and testify to the eighth and ultimate sign, which we will celebrate on Easter Sunday, the eighth and ultimate sign of who Jesus is, which is his resurrection himself. John chapter 11, verses 38 through 44. Jesus, once more deeply moved, came to the tomb. It was a cave with a stone laid across the entrance. "Take away the stone," he said. "But Lord," said Martha, the sister of the dead man, "by this time there is a bad odor, for he has been in there 4 days. Then Jesus said, "Did I not tell you that if you believed, you would see the glory of God?" So they took away the stone. Then Jesus looked up and said, "Father, I thank you that you have heard me. I knew that you always hear me, but I said this for the benefit of the people standing here, that they may believe that you have sent me." When he said this, Jesus called in a loud voice, "Lazarus, come out!" The dead man came out, his hands and feet wrapped with strips of linen and a cloth around his face. Jesus said to them, "Take off the grave clothes and let him go." This is the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God. Please be seated.
Well, after spending the day outside yesterday, I went up to my room to work on my sermon a little bit, and I came back down to get a glass of water, and my 9-year-old son looked at me with this awful face, and he goes, "What happened to you, Dad? Your face is bright red. Are you okay?" And I realized my skin hasn't seen the sun in a long time, and I had turned bright red. I was all sunburned, and I got all panicky that I was going to be looking like a lobster up here this morning. But the good news is that after a full day outside, soccer games, and we went to Jamestown Settlement and different things, my boys have decided to stop praying for snow. So we are going to enjoy spring and summer. Some of you have been texting me prayer requests saying, "Hey, your boys are great at getting snow. Tell them to start praying. I win the lottery." And so I'm raising 3 little prayer warriors, but we have decided as a family that we'll stop praying for snow. So you're all safe until next winter. They did a good job praying it in this year. But we're going to continue in our study of John this morning. And as Travis said, for the last 5 or 6 weeks of Lent, we've been looking at the Gospel of John. And in particular, we have been looking at the first half of the Gospel of John. John's first half of his Gospel is organized around 7 signs. These signs point us to Christ. These signs reveal something about Jesus' character. These signs lead us in our journey. The series is called "Where Will Following Lead?" And these signs remind us that as we follow Jesus, they lead us into different things. It's been so encouraging to hear different readers read some of the answers to the questions that have come in. Where has following led you? And what signs have you seen along the way? Well, on our journey together through preaching through the first part of John, we've looked at some of these signs. We looked at Jesus turning water into wine, and we saw that following Jesus leads us into abundant life. As we looked at Jesus healing the official's son, we realized that following Jesus leads to healing and wholeness and reconciliation. That when we looked at Jesus walking on water, we see that following Jesus leads us into a place of peace. Through feeding the 5,000, we saw that following Jesus leads us into a place of provision. Last week, as we studied how Jesus gave the man who was born blind sight, we looked at how following Jesus leads us to sight. And Doug also challenged us that in that passage, we could see that it leads us to witness and to share our faith. He asked a question that's still ringing in my brain a week later. Is witnessing more prevalent in the Gospel of John than it is in my own life. Where will following lead? Today, as we look at the raising of Lazarus, we'll see that following Jesus leads to life. It leads to resurrection. Jesus says in this passage, "I am the resurrection and the life. He who believes in me will never die." That following Jesus leads to life. Well, John sort of played his hand. He showed us his cards when he, later in his gospel, he said, "This is why I've organized the first half of the gospel this way." And he, in chapter 20, verses 30 and 31, he says, "Jesus did many other miraculous signs in the presence of the disciples, which are not recorded in this book. But these are written, the seven that he chose, these are written so that you might believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that by believing, you may have life in his name." There's two words I want to draw your attention to in this verse, because these are important words for John, and they're important words as we study this passage today. One is the word believe. John uses this word 98 times in his gospel. If you add up all the times that Matthew, Mark, and Luke use the word believe, you don't even get a quarter of that amount. That this word believe is so important to John, because John will tell us that if you believe, then you will have life. Life is another one of those words that we see throughout John's gospel that we don't see as common in the other gospels. Matthew, Mark, and Luke, they use it combined less than half the amount of times that John uses the word life. These two words are all throughout our passage of Scripture today. In fact, if you look in John 11, you'll see that Jesus uses this word believe several times. In talking to his disciples in verse 14 and 15, he says, "Lazarus is dead, and for your sake, I am glad I was not there, so that you might believe." In talking to Martha on his way to Bethany, he stops her and says, "I am the resurrection and the life. He who believes in me will live even though he dies, and whoever lives and believes in me will never die." And then he asks, "Do you believe this?" Finally, in verse 42, as he prays before Lazarus' tomb, he says, "I said this for the benefit of the people standing here, that they may believe that you sent me." John wants us to believe. Jesus wants us to believe, because if we believe, then we cross from death into life. Believe. But what does believe mean? What does believing in Jesus Christ look like? It's somewhat of an abstract thought. I mean, if one of my boys came to me and says, "Dad, what does it mean to believe in something?" It's an interesting word. I mean, I could say I believe in something, but just say, "Yeah, I recognize that those statements sound pretty good." Or do I believe it? Do I put it into action? Susie, my wife, and I are wired very differently. And one of the ways in which we're wired differently is that I tend to lock doors, turn off lights, and turn down the thermostat. My wife doesn't do this. She doesn't often lock doors, turn off lights, or turn down the thermostat. Now, she's probably going to get me for this. It's not true. She does. I'm sort of overstating it, but not really. She grew up, her family didn't even own a key to their house. They didn't even lock their door and they went on vacation. So it's a different mindset for Susie and I. And often, I go to bed before Susie. I like a lot of sleep. Susie doesn't seem to need much at all. So I'll be up in bed, and she'll come up eventually, and I'll say, "Did you lock the doors and turn off the lights and turn down the thermostat?" She'll say, "Yeah, of course I did." And I'll lay there in bed, and I'll sort of toss and turn for a few minutes. "Did she really? Did I just hear the furnace go on?" I mean, I am my dad. It is so scary, right? My dad goes into rooms and just turns the lights out when you're in them, right? It's true, Dad. Okay. But I'll toss and turn, and then I'll get up and I'll go downstairs. Maybe I'll pretend I'm getting a glass of water. But what I'm doing is I'm checking the doors, the thermostat, the lights, and I'll come back upstairs, and Susie will say, "Didn't you believe me?" That's her laughing. "Didn't you believe me? I said I turned off all the lights and the thermostat and the doors," and I'll sort of say, "Well, I guess not. Maybe I don't really believe you. Because if I believed you, I would have been able to go right back to bed and sleep just fine. But I tossed and turned, and then I went downstairs for a glass of water so I could check everything. And most of the time, it is all right where it should be. Lights off, doors locked, thermostat down. But belief takes action. It's more than just putting in your brain this idea that, yeah, I believe my wife. No, it means that I got to act upon that belief. We look at our passage of Scripture today. I think John is going to give us a picture of what belief looks like. The gospel writer is going to share with us a picture of what it truly means to believe in Jesus Christ. He does so in a setting of death. It's an interesting setting. This whole story that we'll go through together, this whole chapter and even into chapter 12, death is in the air. It's not just there because Lazarus is dying. I mean, that's part of it. We see death because Lazarus is sick and will die. There's death there. But this story takes place in a little town called Bethany. Now, I did a little research and tried to learn a few things, and I have a map of the area. You'll see all the dotted lines kind of come together in Jerusalem, the center of everything that's going on. And just to the east, just to the right of Jerusalem, you see the little town of Bethany, 1 or 2 miles from the heart of Jerusalem. Bethany, when translated, can mean some various different things. One, it can mean house of the poor, but it can also mean house of affliction or house of misery. When that little shepherd boy found the Dead Sea Scrolls in those caves in Qumran, they found a bunch of writings about a town called Bethany, about a place just outside of Jerusalem where those who were sick and dying and destitute would come out not only to receive care, but to die. That the town of Bethany is covered in the stench of death. That the residents of Bethany are used to people coming to Bethany to die. So we see death in Lazarus. We see death in the town of Bethany. We also see death looming for Jesus. Jesus tells his disciples, he shares, "It is not my hour yet for death, but it's on the horizon." We can see it in the nervousness of his disciples. When he tells them, "Hey, we're going to go to Judea," they say, "No way. If we go to Bethany, they'll certainly kill you, Jesus." In John chapter 5, the Jewish leaders have already plotted a plan to kill Jesus. In John chapter 10, they actually picked up rocks and were ready to stone him right there on the spot. But he escaped. It's not his hour yet, but the disciples are thinking that death is coming. They are nervous. The reality is that as death looms in the air in Bethany, as Lazarus lay dying, as death is there, we realize that death is in our lives as well. You don't have to live long on this planet to realize that death and the reality of death invades our lives. I was 13 when I first experienced death in a really real and substantial way. I was away at summer camp. I spent my summers, or at least 2 weeks of my summer, in the Adirondacks of New York at a boys' camp. And part of what we did is we would go out hiking. I signed up with a bunch of other 13-year-old boys to go on a hike of a mountain called Giant Mountain, a mountain as part of the High Peaks Range in the Adirondacks of New York. It's going to be several days that we were going to be hiking in that area. And all of the boys that signed up, we got to know each other. And I met one kid my age, he was 13, named Eric. And as we started out that one morning to hike up Giant Mountain, we realized that Eric had forgotten his sweater and his hat. That even in the summertime on top of those mountains in the Adirondacks, the wind would whip through and you'd get to the top all hot and sweaty and you'd want to put something warm on because you could chill down and get hypothermia real quick. I had brought extra coats and things, so I gave Eric my sweater and my hat and we started hiking together. Just about a quarter mile from the top, Eric sat down on the trail breathing heavily. Within minutes, he had stopped breathing altogether. I watched my two counselors who were college students at Messiah College in Pennsylvania. They gave him CPR for 2.5 hours because they did not want to be responsible for losing a child on their trip. Eventually, a doctor hiked by and he said to them, "You don't need to do this anymore. This child is never going to live again." I remember hiking back down the mountain, leaving my friend Eric on the top, dead, wearing my sweater and my hat, and wondering, what is this thing, this death, this reality of death that invades all of our lives and brings pain and confusion and suffering and despair? And it's within this setting of death that Jesus comes and says, "I am the resurrection and the life. Do you believe this?" That it's in this setting of death that Jesus comes and says, "I have conquered death. Will you believe?" John is inviting his readers to believe. Jesus is speaking and inviting us to believe. And the question is posed, what does it look like to believe in Jesus? Let's look at this story and see if we can find the picture that John paints of what it looks like to believe. The story begins in chapter 11. As we said, Lazarus is sick. He has a sister, Martha, and another sister, Mary. John gives a really interesting detail in the beginning of chapter 11. He says, Lazarus has a sister, Mary. And then he says to his readers, "This is the one that anointed Jesus' feet with perfume." What's interesting about that fact is it hasn't even happened yet in the Gospel of John. That John brings our attention to something that will happen in the future. I wonder, are John's initial readers, have they heard of this Mary? Have they heard of this woman that anointed Jesus' feet with perfume and wiped his feet with her hair? Is he saying that so that they go, "Oh yeah, I've heard of this woman"? Or is John pointing us to the end of the story saying, "Don't stop until you get to this part where Mary anoints Jesus' feet"? Anyway, we learn that Lazarus has two sisters, Mary and Martha, and they have sent ahead for Jesus. Throughout the Gospels, we can see that Bethany was a spot that Jesus liked to come stay. On his way through, he would stay in Bethany, and he had developed a relationship with this family. And now Lazarus, who he loves, is sick and dying. And Jesus declares, "This sickness will not end in death." And then Jesus does the funniest thing ever. He stays where he is for 2 days. 2 days he stays there. He knows Lazarus is sick. He knows Mary and Martha want him. And yet he stays put for 2 days. Isn't that God's timing in our life sometime? That frustrating timing where we pray and beg for Jesus to show up and figure something out in our life, and it seems like he just sits and stays put for a few days, a few weeks, a few months. But God's timing is perfect. And in the moment when Jesus wants to, he says to his disciples, "Come on, let's go. We're going to Judea. We're going to Bethany. We're going to go see Lazarus." And the disciples again, they say, "No way. We're not putting ourselves in harm's way." And he says, "We are going." And it says Jesus plainly spoke to them and said, "We're going. And we're doing this so that you will believe." And disciple Thomas, who always gets a bad rap for being the doubting Thomas, right? He speaks up and he says, "Come on, guys, let's go with them. At least we can die with Jesus. A little bit of courage, a little bit of misunderstanding, but not so much the doubting Thomas that he always gets the bad rap for. At least he says, come on, guys, let's go. If Jesus is going to die, let's die with him. Well, Jesus heads to Bethany, and he's walking on his journey, and he stops just outside Bethany, and Martha comes to him. And Martha's first words are, if only, Jesus, you had showed up a few days earlier. If only you had been here, my brother would not be dead. Jesus learns that Lazarus has been in the tomb for 4 days. And Martha, distraught and frustrated, says, if only, Jesus, you had been here. Jesus responds with words this time, and he says, Martha, I am the resurrection and the life. He who believes in me will live, even though he dies. And whoever lives and believes in me will never die. Do you believe this, Martha? Do you believe this? Martha says she does, and she runs back to get Mary. As I was contemplating this verse, I was reading from N.T. Wright, a scholar in England. He wrote a little bit about this. He says, I am the resurrection and the life, Jesus says. Resurrection isn't just a doctrine. It isn't just a future fact. It's a person. And here he is standing in front of Martha, teasing her to make the huge jump of trust and hope. He is challenging her, urging her to exchange her if only for an if Jesus. Jesus asks Martha, do you believe? And he asks us, do you believe? Martha runs home to get Mary, and Mary gets up from her mourning, and she heads out to meet Jesus. And everyone in the house that was there mourning with her says, oh, she must be going to Lazarus's tomb. And they follow her out there, and she stops, and she meets with Jesus, and she says the same words, Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died. And this time, instead of answering this question with words, Jesus says, show me where he's buried. Martha and Mary says, come see. And the crowd follows Jesus and Mary, and Martha's there too, to the tomb of Lazarus, where a stone has been rolled in front, and he has been in there for 4 days. And Jesus says, all right, move the stone. And Martha, oh, practical Martha, says, but Jesus, it's going to stink. The smell of death is coming out of this tomb. He's been in there 4 days. You know what heat and humidity does to dead Lazarus in 4 days? Jesus says, I got this. And he prays, and he gives thanks, and he says, I am doing this so you will all believe. And then he says, Lazarus, come on out. And Lazarus comes walking out, wrapped in grave clothes, his face covered with a sheet. And he says, hey, I'm alive. What would you do if you were there? I asked myself that. Like, if I was standing there, if I was part of that crowd, the stone gets rolled away, I'm getting a little creeped out, maybe I'm backing up a little bit, and Jesus calls on Lazarus, and Lazarus comes out, what would you do? Would you be like, all right, unwrap him. I want to see if that's really the guy. Would you take off running the other direction? Would you prepare for the zombie apocalypse? Would you be scared? Would you be in awe? Would you be silent? What would your response be? Well, John, the gospel writer, asks us, are you going to believe? John has set this account of Lazarus' raising from the dead, that Jesus raising Lazarus from the dead, up to this point so that he can ask us, do you believe? Because there's only two answers, yes or no. Do you believe? John continues his story, his retelling of this account, and we get to see two different reactions, reaction of belief and the reaction of unbelief. See, many are there in the crowd, it says in chapter 11. Many believe. Many people see Lazarus walk out of that tomb and they go, okay, I gotta believe in that guy because that's awesome. But some of them go back to the Jewish leaders and they say, he did it. He raised Lazarus from the dead. We got to do something about this. It's not that they're denying that Jesus did it, but they aren't connecting the dots that they need to follow this guy. And they plan to kill him. And they plot to kill him. And they put together a plan that says, we're going to get Jesus. And then in chapter 12, we get a different picture. We get a picture of Mary who believes. Not the Jewish leaders who don't believe, but Mary who believes. You can read with me in chapter 12. I'll read right from the text for this. It says, 6 days before the Passover, Jesus arrived at Bethany where Lazarus lived, whom Jesus had raised from the dead. Here a dinner was given in Jesus' honor. Martha served while Lazarus was among those reclining at the table with him. Imagine, like, that's just wild, right? Imagine just chilling with the guy that was dead for 4 days. Then Mary took a pint of pure nard, an expensive perfume. She poured it out on Jesus' feet and wiped it with her hair. And the house was filled with the fragrance of perfume. The stench of death did not hang over Bethany now, but the fragrance of life. One of the disciples, Judas Iscariot, who was later to betray him, objected. Why wasn't this perfume sold and the money given to the poor? It was worth a year's wages. He did not say this because he cared about the poor, but because he was a thief. Remember where we found that word thief before in John? John 10:10. A thief comes only to kill, destroy, steal. And Jesus says, I have come to bring life. Judas is looking out for himself. It says, as keeper of the money bag, he used to help himself to whatever he put in it. In the middle of the Jewish leader's response and of Judas's response of unbelief, we get a picture of belief that is beautiful and real, and it takes action. And Mary's picture of her response to what Jesus did, her response to the resurrection and the life, is a response of belief. Looking at these two, we can separate it into three quick things. We can see that her response, one, it was a surrender of her power. Right? If you look at the Jewish leaders, part of the reason why they weren't going to go for Jesus is they had to change everything. I mean, they had a deal going with the Romans, and they were figuring this all out. They had power and leadership and authority, and they ruled. Mary undoes her hair and wipes Jesus' sandy, dirt-covered feet with perfume and her hair. And in a sign of humility, shows that he is her authority and her power in her life. In contrast, the Jewish leaders, they'll have nothing to do with it. Don't invade my life. I'm not giving up my power. Mary's response also speaks to her surrender of not just her power, but of her plans. Mary had plans for that perfume, but you know what? I believe in Jesus, so I'm going to do everything I can to worship that man. Meanwhile, the Jewish leaders, they want nothing to do with it. He's not messing up our plans. We got plans to rule this place. But Mary surrenders. Mary says, your plans are my plans. Mary says, your ways are my ways. And Mary surrenders her possessions. Judas' response, hey, that perfume is worth a year's wages, helps us see that this was a big sacrifice. This was a huge thing that she was giving up to Jesus. But in this picture of belief, we see that we don't hold anything back, but we respond to the resurrection and the life by saying, everything I have is yours. Take it. Judas is thinking, no, I want that in my pocket. When we ask ourselves, what does belief look like? What does it look like to believe in Jesus Christ? Mary paints this beautiful picture for us. But there are other pictures around us as well. This week, I had the honor of going to a ceremony celebrating the life of Mel Roche. Mel Roche is a true saint of the Lord. He was 94 years old when he died. Many of you may not know who Mel is, but you may have seen him. He was one of the few guys that would roll up front here in a wheelchair on Sunday mornings. He couldn't see real well, so we got him as close to the front as we could. He was always smiling and always engaged in what was happening here at the chapel. I've known Mel for 10 years, but that celebration of life service on Friday blew me away. I sat and listened to the stories as people talked about Mel's life, and I thought, this is a picture of what it means to believe in Jesus. He grew up on a small farm in Illinois. During the Depression, he hopped freight trains around the country as a hobo, picking fruit and vegetables where he could. Then, after the Depression was over, he put himself through school and got a degree in engineering. And during World War II, he enlisted and became a pilot. He was shot down over Europe in Hungary, and he spent 9 months in a German POW camp. He was rescued by the Russian army. So enthralled with his flight training, he went back to school and got a degree in aeronautical engineering. And after that, he worked for NASA before NASA was NASA. He's considered one of the heroes that got a man on the moon. Mel was bright, really bright, and really driven. And then at the age of 57, he said, you know what? I'm going to give up my job at NASA, and I'm going to run Young Life here in Williamsburg. And the room was filled with people that met Jesus Christ through Mel Roche. And people told stories of the hundreds and thousands of, well, once children, now adults, not only here in Williamsburg, but around the world that knew Jesus Christ because Mel believed and found life. And his life was a beautiful fragrance that filled the room and covered the stench of death. What does it look like to believe in Jesus Christ? That's the question that John is asking us this morning. That's the question that Jesus keeps asking. Do you really believe? Mel believed. Mary believed. Do you believe? As Grant comes to lead us in a few more songs this morning, let us ponder and consider this question. Do I believe in Jesus Christ?